We're talking to Richard Heinberg, senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of 10 books. His most recent book is The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Great. Good to be with you.
Thanks, Richard. Yes. And we've had you on the other side of the news once before, way back in the beginning when we were talking about peak oil. And now we're watching all the gas stations run out of fuel around the Toronto, Southern Ontario area anyway. I don't know what it's doing out west and in the States. You know, your book is so full of stuff. I didn't know where to start.
Oh, well, thank you.
I mean, I know a lot of this, but I'm thinking some of the listeners don't know half this stuff, and I just don't know where to begin. What we're seeing is, it's happening right now, what you're talking about.
Right, right.
I don't know how many interviews you've started to do already with this book, so you will have a better idea of what things other interviewers are looking at and looking for.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, this is probably number 20 or so.
Wow. Do you see a stream of the same types of questioning?
Different interviewers focus in on different aspects of it. Some who are, you know, more environmental folks will focus on the ecological limits, and others, you know, sort of mainstream people will focus on the financial parts of the argument, but
right.
If whatever you want to talk about is fine with me.
Well, they're both so tied together. I do both on the show. I don't do economics much except on how it affects our society, the poor, and the environment. So as Michael Moore says, we've just recently passed the 30th anniversary of how this endless growth economic system has been put together. When Ronald Reagan in 1981 decided, okay, let's go for free trade, let's do these other items. So it's a bubble. It's a phony bubble that anybody under 30 has been living under.
Right. Okay. Right, yeah. It's, we've been talking about the situation with global oil supplies for about a decade now, and back in the early days, of course, the term peak oil was unfamiliar to almost everyone. It still is to some folks, but these days more and more people are coming to understand that world oil supplies just aren't growing anymore. We've seen stagnant world oil production since about 2004. Gradually and sometimes fairly steeply rising oil prices. So this is a very serious economic problem for our society, which is so dependent on oil for transportation, agriculture, petrochemicals, and so on. And it's one of the factors that I believe is leading to the end of economic growth as we've known it.
Yes, because our economy is wrapped around oil. Ever since the 40s, everything that we put together as a society has been based on oil. Is that
right?
The same time that the dollar, and everything's in American terms, and we're in Canada here, so things are slightly different, but when the dollar was tied to gold?
Right. Well, that had been true for many decades, and it was only in, I believe it was 1971, that Nixon closed the window at the Treasury for foreign nations to trade dollars for gold. U.S. citizens hadn't had that opportunity for a very long time, for many decades, but it was still possible for nations to do that. And France at the time in the early 70s was trading a lot of dollars for gold, and of course the U.S. was borrowing a lot of money to wage the Vietnam War at the time, and so a lot of that debt ended up in European countries, and they were trading it for gold, and Fort Knox was starting to run low on gold, so Nixon closed the window. And since that time, the U.S. dollar has been free-floating in value, and what some folks call a fiat currency. In other words, not having any backing or grounding in any metal or commodity. You know, arguably that has played a role in the blowing up of an enormous debt or credit bubble over the past, especially the past few years, but really has roots going back three or four decades.
Right.
And that again is part of our problem with the growth economy.
But we're seeing it right now with the states, with the problem with the debt.
Yes.
I mean, everything your book is talking about and everything you've been talking about is happening right now. Climate change is happening right now. The dollar being untied from gold. Some places got tied to resources, and Reagan allowed it to become a global economy.
Right.
There's a lot of reasons that we had a system that was constantly growing, that had to have constant growth to survive. And that system has peaked.
Yeah, well, you know, in some ways this goes back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when the whole discipline of economics got its start with Adam Smith and David Ricardo and all those folks. You know, they called themselves philosophers, moral philosophers, and it was only as time went on that economics began to think of it as itself as a science. But in many ways, it's still a branch of philosophy. Economics doesn't follow the same kinds of rules as say physics or biology in terms of performing repeatable experiments and providing proof for assertions and so on. But anyway, during this period of time, the Industrial Revolution, we gained access to fossil fuels, which are these amazingly energy-dense, cheap, abundant sources of fuel. And they enabled us to grow our economy in a way that had never happened before in human history. We've grown our population from fewer than 1 billion to 7 billion today. GDP per capita, personal wealth has shot up by a factor of about 100 since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Of course, it's not evenly distributed. There's still a lot of poor people in the world.
For the 2%, it shot up.
Well, actually, if you average that out among the entire world population, GDP per capita has skyrocketed over the past century. All of that was largely the result of having cheap energy with which to do stuff, to make things and transport them and so on. And so economists looked at that, and they thought it was all because of the magic of the market.
Mm.
They never stopped to think that it was because of cheap energy that enabled us to extract other raw materials from the earth and process them and manufacture consumer goods and distribute them. And then for much of the 20th century, the problem was overproduction. We could make stuff faster than people could use it. And so we invented the advertising industry to talk people into using even more stuff, even faster, and turn it into waste. The whole idea of planned obsolescence, you know, came into vogue in Detroit and actually all through the manufacturing chain.
Right. Products had a life cycle where they could be, where they would die, and so the manufacturer put that into his figuring for his economic growth. He knew how many more pieces he was going to sell because he knew
That's
that
right.
his product was going to have a time limit.
That's right. And so all of this fed into economists' ideas that growth was the normal and natural state of an economy, and that all we had to do was get out of the way, you know, get government out of the way. And economies would just grow forever automatically. Of course, the idea is inherently absurd, and a number of scientists have you know, again, biologists, physicists of all stripes have pointed this out for decades, really, that, you know, we live on a finite planet with only so much oil, iron ore, copper, you name it. And so we can't continue growing our consumption forever on a finite planet. There are inherent limits to growth. Now, of course, there's a legitimate debate as to, you know, when we're likely to hit those limits. You know, is it this year, or is it 100 years from now, or 1,000 years from now? And there was a very important study done back in the early 1970s, published under the title Limits to Growth, which in its book form, it was the best-selling environmental book of all time.
Who was that written by?
That was written by Jürgen Randers, Donella Meadows, Dennis Meadows, William Behrens III. I believe that's all of the original authors. Only a couple of them survive, Dennis Meadows and Jürgen Randers, to my knowledge, anyway. And they used computer, a primitive computer by our standards today, and programmed it with information about population growth, resource depletion, the relative abundance of various resources, and also the likely trajectory of environmental damage from pollution from the industrial process. And they ran various scenarios. You know, they tweaked the program and the data in all sorts of ways. But the standard run scenario, which was quite robust, showed again and again a decline of industrial activity beginning in the first two decades of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
Well, since 1972, of course, computers have gotten a lot better. Our data have gotten a lot better. And, of course, they've continued to rerun those scenarios, and with similar results. And here we are at the end of the first decade of the 21st century, beginning of the second decade of the 21st century, and it appears that we have hit those limits to growth. We are seeing the world economy very fragile. The U.S. economy is treading water, even as the government injects enormous sums of liquidity into the economy to keep it floating.
We're seeing they should in Europe, never have done.
Well, yes, that's all debatable as to whether you know, it was a good idea to bail out the banks, or whether there was a much better use for that money. But the European countries, peripheral countries now, including Italy and Spain, not so peripheral, are you know, swirling down the drain. And it we talked earlier about oil prices. We're seeing increasing costs from environmental disasters. All of these things are signs very clearly connected with the original limits to growth study that suggests that in fact we have reached those limits, and economic growth as we've known it is basically over. We can argue again about the details and you know, what's going on in China and India and whether we might be able to get a few more dribs and drabs of growth from investing in alternative energy supplies and so on. But the basic outline, I think, is emerging pretty clearly that the growth era that started several decades ago is now coming to an end.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You get a lot of pushback on that theory, don't you?
Well, yes, of course. And sometimes from unexpected quarters. You know, I had expected when I wrote the book that, you know, mainstream economists would disparage it, not take it very seriously. But I thought, you know, generally environmentalists would understand and embrace the idea. But, you know, I've been doing dozens of radio interviews since the book came out. And ironically enough, some, certainly not all, but a few of the environmental programs that I've been on, folks have, you know, really have trouble with this idea, because they believe that, you know, if we just switch from dirty energy sources, fossil fuels, to wind and solar, then we can create, you know, all kinds of jobs and have more endless economic growth and in perpetuity. And I think the idea is, and this is very, very deep-seated in our society, the idea is that economic growth comes from money. You know, and if we're spending more money on energy, if we're spending more money on creating jobs and so on, well, we can just have growth forever. It really takes a while for people to begin to understand that economic activity fundamentally requires energy and raw materials. And money is just a symbol for those. So if we're trying to get a lot of economic activity happening and there aren't enough raw materials, there isn't enough energy, and we keep throwing money at things, what happens is money loses value. And that's, economists call that inflation or hyperinflation. There's more money changing hands, but the real economic activity is not happening. And we're starting to see a situation like that emerge in the economy, not necessarily in the form. Actually, that's an oversimplification because there's also another scenario, which is a deflationary scenario, in which debt is built up to unsustainable levels, and that's actually the form that our problem is taking in most countries around the world. In China, they're seeing inflation, but in the U.S., we're seeing deflation.
Speaking of China, we could probably go there at this point as an example of their playing catch-up to the Western society.
Sure.
The fact that, is it still true that every 4 minutes they have a new coal plant or coal mine?
Well, I think that's overstating the situation. Certainly, China's coal consumption is ravenous. The country uses 3.5 billion tons of coal per year, which is 3.5 times as much as the U.S., which had been the world's biggest coal consumer for many decades. And China is probably reaching the limits to its ability to continue increasing its coal supply. Coal is certainly a very abundant fuel in the Earth's crust, but it's not limitless. And we're going about, and certainly China is going about, extracting coal using the familiar low-hanging fruit principle. You know, we go after the highest quality, cheapest, easiest to access stuff first and leave the nasty, dirty, expensive, environmentally ruinous stuff for later. And with coal, as with oil, it's later. China is starting to import coal from other nations like Australia and Indonesia, but the total world coal export trade is pretty small relative to China's production. It's only about 700 million tons per year versus China's 3.5 billion tons consumption. So China is going to be able to absorb entire world coal export capacity with only another 2 or 3 years worth of economic growth. And that will, of course, you know, once that happens, then coal prices globally will shoot up, and China will no longer be able to grow its economy. Now, of course, China is trying to bring on alternative energy sources also as fast as it can, nuclear, wind, solar, and so on. But it's so dependent on coal. That's, 70% of its total energy is from coal. So it's not really going to be possible for China to continue growing its economy once its coal supplies are start leveling off and declining. And that, again, that's likely to happen within the next 5 years.
And they're so busy adding cars to roads and adding roads to, it's amazing what they're doing, building bridges.
Right. Well, China's oil demand is what's driving the world oil markets right now. Demand from the U.S. and Europe is flat. But demand from China and, to a lesser extent, India is rapidly increasing. And so when we see oil prices march ahead, that's an indication, first of all, of confidence in the markets that there's somehow a recovery in the U.S. and Europe, so that there will be solid demand there. But also, it's just recognition of the fact that, as you say, the Chinese are building all of these roads and buying cars The Chinese automobile market is now bigger than the car market in the U.S.
Yes, it's amazing. Well, it's just the last 10 or 15 years they built an island so that they can unload these big tankers, these huge tankers that they built.
Right.
It's just, you know, you stand back and you look at it and you wonder. It's like looking at the Dubai scenario.
Right.
You're just wondering, why do people, what are people thinking? So it's not just the states, which we focus on here in Canada quite a bit. What's the states? What are they doing? I'm angry. A lot of people are angry about Harper and his deals being made with the tar sands and the pipeline and the roads that he has, so that various buyers in the states will have that dirty oil. And a lot of the refineries being built on water, next to water.
Right.
So,
yeah, of course, the tar sands are a manifestation of this, you know, low-hanging fruit principle that we were talking about. Now that the cheap, easy oil is drying up around the world, the incentive is to go after, you know, lower and lower grade hydrocarbon resources. And as we do that, two things happen. First of all, the energy and economic payoff is much lower. You know, we use energy not to generate dollars. You know, we use energy primarily to get stuff done, and then we, you know, that may generate dollars in the process. But is important to us because of what it will do for us. And it takes energy to get energy. It requires an energy investment to drill for oil, to explore for oil, to pump oil, and so on. But the amount of energy historically that we had to invest was minuscule in comparison with the energy payoff.
And then the terrible environmental damage as a result.
If we struck oil. But with the lower grade hydrocarbon resources like tar sands, the energy payback is much, much lower. It's on the in the range of 3-to-1 or 5-to-1, whereas historically with conventional oil, it was more in the range of 50 or 100-to-1. So in the old days of conventional oil, you know, most of society's effort could be diverted to all kinds of projects, you know, proliferating industries and consumer products and jobs and so on. But as the energy profit ratio from our energy production processes starts to fall back again, as we go after lower and lower grade hydrocarbon resources, then more and more of society's total capacity has to be diverted to the energy production process. More and more jobs for energy production, fewer and fewer jobs in other areas. More and more investment capital has to go into pipelines and refining and so on, and less investment capital is available for schools and all the other things we want to do. That's just one aspect of this, you know, this low-hanging fruit problem. Then the other is, as you say, you know, we have worse and worse environmental impacts, whether it's from tar sands or from hydrofracking of natural gas, or drilling for oil in miles of ocean water, as has been happening in the Gulf of Mexico and off the coast of Brazil, and of course there, where an accident happens, it can devastate entire ecosystems. So, you know, all of this it should be a very clear warning sign to our society that we need to change energy paradigm. You know, we can't keep going down this road toward lower and lower grade hydrocarbon resources. It's not only environmentally ruinous, it's also economically ruinous.
Because of the tie to the economy on it, and
right.
That oil is behind so many other products that are being manufactured, which the
right,
oil companies
yeah.
are so quick.
We've allowed these fuels to become the very sinews of our of our economy, whether
right.
it's for transportation or industrial chemicals, lubricants. It's all the way through the system.
Yeah, it's really embedded itself in our society. So that one, extracting ourselves from that, is going to be difficult. The end of the story is these transition towns being back to Main Street ideas and barter system ideas. We're doing a lot here in Hamilton that is like that. But that's the only thinking that can escape what we're facing, basically just opting out of the entire economic system that we've been surrounded with for 30 or 40 years.
Right. Well, you know, in the last couple of chapters of The End of Growth, I discuss what governments can and should be doing to transition away from the growth paradigm and what families and communities can do. As you mentioned, the transition movements, and I'd like to talk more about that in a minute. But I think it's also important to realize that, you know, the end of growth is not the end of the world, necessarily.
Right.
We had a non-growing economy fundamentally for, you know, most of our existence as a species. It's really only the last few decades that we've gotten hooked on growth. And if we were to make some simple, basic changes to our economic system, we could have perfectly functional economies and communities without this expectation of constant growth. We'll have to reinvent money, reinvent our financial system in some pretty basic ways, but these things can be done. People
really?
Realize that.
Do you want to
go
through that possibility?
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, one thing that I think is really important is changing our indicators. Right now, we depend so much on GDP,
right.
Gross Domestic Product. It's basically just a measure of how much money we're spending in the economy on an annual basis. And we use GDP as the measure of the health of our economy. So anything that we can do to boost GDP, well, that's what we do. Now, the problem is that GDP is a perverse indicator, and this has been pointed out for decades. If we're spending more money on weapons, for example, if there's a war, GDP goes up. If we have an environmental disaster, very often the process of recovering from it raises the GDP at least temporarily. Sometimes if it cost us more money to put people in prison than those people would generate if they were out of prison and working. Well, actually, putting those people in prison then raises the GDP.
Mm.
You know, so using GDP as our measure of economic health has skewed a lot of things in society. It's skewed our political choices, our economic choices, and I bring this up because now we're at a point in history where it's probably no longer possible to grow GDP for the reasons we've been talking about. We've reached the limits to debt. We've reached the limits to energy. We've reached the limits to the supplies of a whole range of metals and minerals that, you know, were getting cheaper and cheaper up until about the year 2000 as we were using lots of cheap energy to mine deeper and to refine lower grade ores. But now, since about the year 2000, as energy has been getting more expensive, copper, zinc, antimony, indium, gallium, long, long list of important industrial metals and materials that we mine out of the Earth's crust have been getting more and more expensive. All of these things and more are limiting our ability to expand consumption and growth in the conventional sense that we measure by GDP. So it's absolutely essential that we adopt other indicators that that target, measure quality of life. How well are we doing as people? Are we happy? What's the integrity of our environment? Are we at peace? Is our society content and law-abiding society? None of those things are measured by GDP, but if we started paying attention to them and measuring them, we would find out, and there's a lot of data to back this up, we would find out that it's possible to increase our quality of life while decreasing our consumption of material goods and energy.
Sorry, is that tied into the dopamine thinking that you were
Yeah, right. I do talk in the book about how our neural reward systems work and how, you know, there are certain neurotransmitters like dopamine that we we unconsciously try to, you know, maximize and give ourselves a little hit of, whether, and very often that takes the form of, especially in our society, increasing consumption. And partly we've been advertised into that. You know, we talked earlier about how the advertising industry was created during the 20th century to stoke demand for consumer products. But what the advertisers did was connect our dopamine reward systems to the act of purchasing stuff.
Right.
And this became so successful that for the past 30 years, what we've done is people have been so keen on increasing their purchasing and consuming of stuff that they've gone into greater and greater levels of debt in order to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So today, consumer debt is absolutely maxed out. You know, most Canadians and U.S. citizens are loaned up to their eyeballs with house mortgages and car payments and all the rest, credit card debt. So, and that's a constraint on further growth, because the way our economy is currently structured, the only way it can get back to a state of continual growth is if more people can take on more debt, which just doesn't seem possible at the current time.
Well, not with the way our system has been changed, so that only a handful made billions upon billions, and the middle class has disappeared. There's so many people jobless and homeless as a result of our economy, the way it's set up. The tax breaks, everybody seems to think, well, let's give the rich a tax break and it'll create more jobs. Well, it doesn't. They just take that extra income and put it in their own bank account and say, thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of this started back in the late 1970s and especially in the 80s. Up until the 1970s in North America, we were we had lots of cheap energy, and what we were doing with that was manufacturing stuff and exporting it to the rest of the world. And that created a big demand for labor, and so wages, hourly wages, reached their all-time peak around 1973 here in the U.S., and they've stagnated ever since, because mm-hmm. what happened then was that globalization started. Manufacturers realized they could get cheaper labor overseas, and with the invention of container ships and satellites and computers, it became possible to globalize supply chains and manufacturing and distribution. So since the early 1970s, as wages have stagnated, we've maintained a consumer economy, again, as we were talking about just a minute ago, through increasing consumer debt. So this has worked to the advantage, of course, of the companies that are employing workers, because they get cheaper labor, and they get to sell all their stuff to willing consumers in North America who buy all this stuff on credit. But it doesn't work to the advantage of the people whose wages have been stagnating and who are now laboring under enormous amounts of debt. The other thing this has done is, by generating all of this consumer debt, now there's this giant pool of money that gets invested in Wall Street and ultimately in pension funds, hedge funds, investment banks, and so on, turning up as collateralized debt, as mortgage-backed securities, and finally as derivatives. So there's this giant pyramid of debt, derivatives, and securities that it's like an inverted pyramid. You know, it's the bottom of the pyramid, the basis of the pyramid is all this consumer debt.
Mm-hmm.
But then all of these further financial instruments are written on top of that debt, and whereas, you know, the actual amount of consumer debt is just a few trillion dollars, not exactly pocket change, but the overall sort of inverted pyramid of debt that's built on that is in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. And all of this is a pyramid scheme.
Yeah, Ponzi.
Yep. It's a Ponzi scheme.
Ponzi scheme.
In essence.
So
yeah,
let's move on. You had a list of, we've talked about how you should change your thinking, and that's the tough part, I think. I mean, we can suggest, you've offered lots of suggestions on what we can do It's getting the mindset changed to do it. And it's going to come upon society rather hard. I think they're going to be forced to do it.
Well, yeah, and you know, when people ask my advice as to what they should be doing in this kind of economy, you know, I have to tell them use their own common sense. You know, clearly, if the future is going to be a shrinking economy, then it makes sense to reduce your consumption, reduce your debt, reduce your spending, and increase your savings. You know, start to become more self-reliant, grow more of your own food, keep chickens in the backyard, get to know your neighbors, start doing things for yourself that you used to pay other people to do. Now, you know, all of that is, I think, very sound advice. The problem is, of course, that if everybody did that, it would cause the economy to contract even faster and further. So we have this bizarre situation where if people do the right thing, they actually cause the problem to get worse. That's how perverse our economy is right now. But there's no other way out. You know, I think we're going to have to get through this by exercising common sense and by doing what does make sense for our families and our communities. And that does mean increasing our self-reliance and our community involvement.
You talk about hubs in the building, common security clubs.
Right, yeah, this is a strategy. Actually, they're calling them resilience circles right now. So if folks want to Google and find out more about this, they can either Google common security clubs or resilience circles. But it's just a way for people to get together in their neighborhoods and find ways to, first of all, compare notes and see how everybody else is doing economically and financially and find ways to help each other out. We're not taught to do, you know, in the normal state of affairs, you know, we're taught to be very secretive about our finances and very independent and not to rely on other people, to be independent as possible. But you know, you look back through history at hard economic times in the past, like the Great Depression, and people got through those times by sharing, by working together, by getting to know their neighbors, by moving in with their family, you know, basic things like that. And that's kind of what the common security clubs are all about. We mentioned the transition initiatives earlier, and that's really important too, because that's like a grassroots movement of folks in their communities getting together to move off of fossil fuels, not waiting for the elected officials to lead the way, but just doing what we can as citizens to build local food movements, to build alternative transport networks, car share, ride share. And the transition towns are taking off around the world. There are something like 300 or 400 of them right now around the world, over 100 in North America. And people get so much out of participation in these kinds of initiatives because they realize they're not just in this on their own, that their friends and neighbors are part of a bigger historical movement. You know, this is what we're talking about, the end of growth and the beginning of a sustainability revolution toward a fundamentally different kind of society that works for people and nature and not for Wall Street investment banks. This is a profound and fundamental historic change. I think it will be viewed in hindsight as being as important as the Industrial Revolution itself.
That's right. This is one of the biggest changes I think humanity has had to face in the last 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
Talking at one point about having people having their own money, just getting right off the grid system altogether and having their own money, I'm trying to look up the quote.
Yeah, I do talk in the book about the need for us to get off of debt-based currency, and this, you know, this it's possible to do this on two levels. First of all, I think it would be a good idea for nations, for Canada, for the U.S. and other countries, the European Union, to start thinking about alternatives to their debt-based currencies, because these currencies are becoming more and more dysfunctional as time goes on, and it's because they're linked to debt.
Mm-hmm.
And money doesn't have to be linked to debt, but there are lots of other possibilities, and I'm not just talking about gold or silver-based currencies. There are all kinds of mutual credit clearing mechanisms that have been experimented with and certainly would work. On the computer, on the internet these days, there's something called Bitcoin. Which is a form of currency that, you know, people can just create and use as they need, and it's very simple, but it's highly secure, you know, and it does the job. It does what a currency needs to do, but it's not being monopolized by the banks. See, this is one of the problems with our current debt-based money system. Because it is based in debt, because money is loaned into existence by banks, it's effectively under the control of banks and works to the advantage of banks. And that's not good for us in the long run.
No, credit union's better, or hopefully better.
Yeah, and you know, communities can also create their own currencies. We don't have to wait for nations to do this. And this is one thing that we often see in transition towns.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first transition towns, of course, probably the first, was Totnes in southern England. And Totnes has its own pound, the Totnes pound.
Right.
The Lewis in southern England also has its own currency, and so on.
It's like a barter system currency, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's barter is an inherently sort of primitive and limited. So having any kind of currency helps with the process of trade. Money is fundamentally just a technology to facilitate trade.
Right.
And as such, it's possible to have many different currencies in use simultaneously. There's no rule that says we have to have just one national or international currency that everybody agrees to abide by.
Okay. We've got some solutions. We're running down to 15 minutes. Maybe we should go over some of the solutions or anything else you would rather cover at the moment.
Yeah, well, as I said, there's a couple of chapters of solutions in the book, and we've talked about some of them, including a switch from GDP to more robust indicators, transition towns, the resilience circles, and so on. One that we haven't talked about is charging interest on purely financial transactions. I mentioned earlier how household debt has gotten blown up into this giant financial bubble, the inverted pyramid of derivatives and securities, and how the detonation of that was at the heart of the financial crisis of 2007-2008 that we're still living in. One way that we could rein in the rampant speculation that caused that bubble and that's still going on and blowing up yet another bubble that is going to burst within the next couple of years, one way that we could rein that in is to charge a tax. It could be a very small tax on the order of 1% or even 0.5% on all purely financial transactions. That would discourage, currency trading and all sorts of derivatives trades that, nobody is really benefiting. Society is not benefiting from those trades. The only purpose is to generate more money for the traders themselves. There's no social benefit from the trade. It's not resulting in a new bridge or a highway or a new consumer product even anything like that. It's just trading pieces of paper. So if we charged a nominal interest fee on that and then rebated that tax to the to society as a whole, perhaps by reducing income taxes or creating a jobs program or an environmental restoration program. Actually, we could fund all of those things, because just currency trades alone mm-hmm. amount to several trillion dollars per day. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling how much money is sloshing around That's in the right. world financial system, doing nothing except, enriching this tiny class of people whose sole interest in life is just making more money.
Making more of that money, right. We were talking about infrastructure, and we're going to, well, we have already serious problems because of climate change, serious problems with torrential rain when it does come that overrides our current system, our current setup. So we're entering in to situations where our drinking sources are becoming polluted, and right. we can't keep up to it.
Well, you know, water is going to be a huge challenge ahead, because with climate change, we see increasing droughts and floods. As the atmosphere warms, it absorbs more water, and so in the process of absorbing water, we see evaporation creating helping to create problem of worsening droughts, and then when the water falls out of the atmosphere, it tends to do so in bigger and bigger precipitation events, creating floods. And then at the same time, of course, we're polluting water, as you say, in more and more ways, as through hydrofracking for natural gas production. Mountaintop removal, coal mining, all sorts of industrial processes. So if we want to leave a legacy to our children, certainly the most important legacy would be a survivable planet, one
right.
with forests and water and fish and all the rest. And this is probably the greatest tragedy of the growth economy. For the sake of immediate economic growth, we're willing to sacrifice the interests of our children and grandchildren.
Find the key for the listeners, the one thing we're missing that will make them get up and go and do it besides panic.
My book, The End of Growth, I think a lot of people will, even looking at the title, think it's a gloomy, depressing book. I hope that's not the case. I have to say it is somewhat pessimistic in the sense that I'm forecasting that our economic future is not going to be what a lot of people would like it to be. But I think that kind of pessimism is really called for, actually,
yeah.
because when people are pessimistic about the financial economy, what do? They start spending less, borrowing less, saving more, and becoming more self-sufficient. And those are exactly the things that people should be doing right now. It's not helpful, however, for people to panic. And unfortunately, our financial system is set up to either make people euphoric or to panic them.
There's that dopamine.
And, right. Neither of those responses is helpful right now. So people, I think the sensible response for people is to, hunker down, sit back, think long term, and by all means, don't panic.
Yes, and as the First Nations people are trying to teach us over and over again, seven generations ahead before you make any decision.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much for allowing us to have this time with you today. I know you're very busy. You're about to take off on a tour.
Yeah, well, thank you, Maggie. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
I'd love it if your tour included Hamilton, Ontario.
Well, I hope it does sometime before too long. I'll let you know when that is.
You'd be surprised if you came to Hamilton. We do have a very active environmentalist group. We have lots of different groups that are all doing different things to do with the environment. We have mm-hmm. a transition town. People think of Hamilton as a steel town, struggling with its unions and struggling with the federal government and struggling with the United States, U.S. steel problem. But, if you look at the other end of Hamilton, we are full of greenery. We are an environmental city. But you have to come and see it.
Oh, well, I look forward to doing so. Thank you.
Okay, Richard, good luck with your book. Good luck with the tour. And thanks for writing this stuff, eh?
Okay, yeah. Well, thanks for having your radio show.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Maggie.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Richard Heimberg, the author of End of Growth. I suggest you pick up the book. It's not that expensive, but the amount of information in it is invaluable. Speaking of stuff, here it is.
Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up. And what the textbook said is that stuff moves through a system from extraction to production to distribution to consumption to disposal. Altogether, it's called the materials economy. There is a lot missing from this explanation. For one thing, this system looks like it's fine. No problem. But the truth is, it's a system in crisis. And the reason it's a system in crisis is it's a linear system, and we live on a finite planet. And you cannot run a linear system on a finite planet indefinitely. Every step along the way, this system is interacting with the real world. In real life, it's not happening on a blank white page. It's interacting with societies, cultures, economies, the environment. And all along the way, it's bumping up against limits. Limits we don't see here because the diagram is incomplete. Well, one of the most important things it's missing is people. Yes, people. People live and work all along this system. And some people in this system matter a little more than others. Some have a little more say. Who are they? Well, let's start with the government. Now, my friends tell me I should use a tank to symbolize the government, and that's true in many countries and increasingly in our own. After all, more than 50% of our federal tax money is now going to the military. But I'm using a person to symbolize the government because I hold true to the vision and values that government should be of the people, by the people, for the people. It's the government's job to watch out for us, to take care of us. That's their job. Then along came the corporation. Now, the reason the corporation looks bigger than the government is that the corporation is bigger than the government. Of the 100 largest economies on Earth now, 51 are corporations. And as the corporation has grown in size and power, we've seen a little change in the government where they're a little more concerned in making sure everything's working out for those guys than for us. We'll start with extraction, which is a fancy word for natural resource exploitation, which is a fancy word for trashing the planet. What this looks like is we chop down the trees, we blow up mountains to get the metals inside, we use up all the water, and we wipe out the animals. So here, we are running up against our first limit. We are running out of resources. We are using too much stuff. Now, I know this can be hard to hear, but it's the truth, so we've got to deal with it. In the past 3 decades alone, 1/3 of the planet's natural resource base has been consumed. Gone. We are cutting and mining and hauling and trashing the place so fast that we're undermining the planet's very ability for people to live here. Where I live, in the United States, we have less than 4% of our original forests left. 40% of the waterways have become undrinkable. And our problem is not just that we're using too much stuff, but we're using more than our share. We have 5% of the world's population, but we're using 30% of the world's resources and creating 30% of the world's waste. If everybody consumed at U.S. rates, we would need 3 to 5 planets. And you know what? We've only got one. So my country's response to this limitation is simply to go take somebody else's. This is the third world, which some would say is another word for our stuff that somehow got on somebody else's land. So what does that look like? The same thing, trashing the place. 75% of global fisheries now are fished at or beyond capacity. 80% of the planet's original forests are gone. In the Amazon alone, we're losing 2,000 trees a minute. That is 7 football fields a minute. And what about the people who live here? Well, according to these guys, they don't own these resources, even if they've been living there for generations. They don't own the means of production, and they're not buying a lot of stuff. And in this system, if you don't own or buy a lot of stuff, you don't have value. So next, the materials move to production. And what happens there is we use energy to mix toxic chemicals in with the natural resources to make toxic contaminated products. There are over 100,000 synthetic chemicals in use in commerce today. Only a handful of them have even been tested for health impacts, and none have been tested for synergistic health impacts. That means when they interact with all the other chemicals we're exposed to every day. So we don't know the full impact on health and the environment of all these toxic chemicals, but we do know one thing. Toxics in, toxics out. As long as we keep putting toxics into our industrial production systems, we're going to keep getting toxics in the stuff that we bring into our homes and workplaces and schools, and duh, our bodies. Like BFRs, brominated flame retardants, they're a chemical that make things more fireproof, but they are super toxic. They're a neurotoxin. That means toxic to the brain. What are we even doing using a chemical like this? Yet we put it in our computers, our appliances, couches, mattresses, even some pillows. In fact, we take our pillows, we douse them in a neurotoxin, then we bring them home and put our heads on them for 8 hours a night to sleep. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me in this country with so much potential, we could think of a better way to stop our heads from catching on fire at night. Now, these toxics build up the food chain and concentrate in our bodies. Do you know what is the food at the top of the food chain with the highest level of many toxic contaminants? Human breast milk. That means that we've reached a point where the smallest members of our societies, our babies, are getting the highest lifetime dose of toxic chemicals from breastfeeding from their mothers. Is that not an incredible violation? Breastfeeding must be the most fundamental human act of nurturing. It should be sacred and safe. Now, breastfeeding is still best, and mothers should definitely keep breastfeeding, but we should protect it. They should protect it. I thought they were looking out for us. And of course, the people who bear the biggest brunt of these toxic chemicals are the factory workers, many of whom are women of reproductive age. They're working with reproductive toxins, carcinogens, and more. Now I ask you, what kind of woman of reproductive age would work in a job exposed to reproductive toxins except for a woman with no other option? And that's one of the beauties of this system. The erosion of local environments and economies here ensures a constant supply of people with no other option. Globally, 200,000 people a day are moving from environments that have sustained them for generations into cities, many to live in slums, looking for work, no matter how toxic that work may be. So you see, it's not just resources that are wasted along this system, but people too. Whole communities get wasted. A lot of the toxics leave the factories in products, but even more leave as byproducts or pollution. And it's a lot of pollution. In the U.S., our industry admits to releasing over 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year. And it's probably a lot more, because that's only what they admit. So that's another limit, because yuck, who wants to look at and smell 4 billion pounds of toxic chemicals a year? So what do? Move the dirty factories overseas, pollute someone else's land. But surprise, a lot of that pollution is coming right back at us, carried by wind currents. So what happens after all these natural resources are turned into products? Well, it moves here for distribution. Now, distribution means selling all the toxic contaminated junk as quickly as possible. The goal here is to keep the prices down, keep the people buying, and keep the inventory moving. How do they keep the prices down? Well, they don't pay the store workers very much, and they skimp on health insurance every time they can. It's all about externalizing the costs. What that means is that the real costs of making stuff aren't captured in the price. In other words, we aren't paying for the stuff we buy. 99% of the stuff we harvest, mine, process, transport, 99% of the stuff we run through this system is trashed within 6 months. How did they get us to jump on board this program so enthusiastically? Well, two of their most effective strategies are planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is another word for designed for the dump. It means they actually make stuff to be useless as quickly as possible, so we'll chuck it and buy a new one. And that brings us to disposal. This is the part of the materials economy we all know the most because we have to haul the junk out to the curb ourselves. Either it gets dumped in a landfill, which is just a big hole in the ground, or if you're really unlucky, first it's burned in an incinerator and then dumped in the landfill. Either way, they both pollute the air, land, water, and don't forget, change the climate. For every one garbage can of waste you put out on the curb, 70 garbage cans of waste were made upstream just to make the junk in that one garbage can you put out on the curb. So even if we could recycle 100% of the waste coming out of our households, it doesn't get to the core of the problems. Also, much of the garbage can't be recycled, either because it contains too many toxics or it's designed not to be recyclable in the first place. Like those juice packs, where they have layers of metal and paper and plastic all smooshed together. You can never separate those for true recycling. So you see, it is a system in crisis. All along the way, we are bumping up against limits. From changing climate to declining happiness, it's just not working. But the good thing about such an all-pervasive problem is that there are so many points of intervention. There are people working here on saving forests and here on clean production, people working on labor rights and fair trade and conscious consuming and blocking landfills and incinerators, and very importantly, on taking back our government so that it really is by the people and for the people. All of this work is critically important, but things are really going to start moving when we see the connections, when we see the big picture. When people along the system get united, we can reclaim and transform this linear system into something new, a system that doesn't waste resources or people.
Redefining Radio. Sing for you.